Long as they keep playing it like that, you know we're gonna be getting somewhere here tonight.
On WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Reese Elmick with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday. Consider walking a few blocks to watch the fireworks in downtown Sarasota this 4th of July. With thousands expected to flock to the fireworks at 9 p.m. this Friday, the Sarasota Police Department will be closing U.S. 41 from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. along the bayfront from Orange Avenue to Gulfstream Avenue. The parking lot at Bayfront will be closed once it has reached maximum capacity, and no parking is permitted on the grassy area on the south end of Bayfront Park. Parking is not allowed in the median on John Ringling Boulevard. Look out for those no parking signs. There will be no parking, stopping, or standing on the John Ringling Bridge either. Expect traffic delays of up to 1 hour when exiting the area due to restricted traffic control following the fireworks. The police department reminds everyone that if you see something, say something, and report any suspicious behavior to law enforcement immediately. AAA Tow-to-Go will be offered to make sure those who are celebrating the holiday get home safely. This is offered from July 4th at 6 a.m. until July 7th at 6 a.m. The Manatee County Commission approved buying two more East County properties for land preservation. There are 4.5 acres next to Rye Preserve and 13 acres next to Crane Park in Mayaca City. The Rye Preserve land will cost more than $300,000, and the Crane Park purchase will cost more than $400,000. Neither of the two properties is expected to require any additional expenses. Within the Rye Preserve land is the Rye Family Cemetery, which is all that remains from the town of Rye. One of the reasons for purchasing this cemetery was to protect the cemetery from development on the north side of the preserve, where more than 400 single-family homes are being built. The Crane Park land sits along the Mayaca River, and it regularly floods during summer. The property's riverbanks and wetlands provide restoration opportunities to improve water quality and wildlife habitats. County staff is focused mainly on the purchase of the land, but will eventually shift toward restorations with the help of a grant from the Coastal and Heartland National Estuary Program. The Florida Department of Transportation opens a new Legacy Trail overpass bridge over Clark Road this morning. Construction of the overpass at Clark Road and the Bee Ridge Road, which was completed last month, cost $13 million. An official ribbon-cutting celebration is scheduled for July 21st. This project required the cooperation of Sarasota County, the Trust for Public Land, and the Friends of Legacy Trail. Around 65,000 bikers, runners, and walkers use the Legacy Trail annually. Stairs at both overpasses are still under construction, but both will be open to the public for the holiday weekend. This has been Reese Helmick with your WSLR News Headlines for Wednesday.
Good morning. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. My name is Bob Connors, and this is the Peace and Justice Report. Can be heard every Wednesday. Tom Walker will be back next Wednesday. Tom and I alternate weeks on the Peace and Justice Report. And I would like to mention that the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. So with that being said, I have a special guest on the phone. Let me see if, Roland, are you there?
I am here, Bob.
Oh, great, great, great. Yes, Roland, I just want to read a little bit about you before I have you take over. So let me let the listeners know that your name is Roland Marullo, an award-winning author. Is it 24 or 27 books now?
28 books.
And one of the books was Breakfast with Buddha, a nominee for the International Impact Dublin Literary Award, now in its 20th printing. the Talk Funny Girl, a 2012 Alex Award winner, and named a must-read by the Massachusetts Library Association and the Massachusetts Center for the Book. And The Vatican Waltz, named one of the best books of 2013 by Publishers Weekly. Lunch with Buddha, selected as one of the best books of 2013 by Kirkus Reviews. And 28 books, Roland?
Yeah.
I'd like to tell the listeners how I happened to get in touch with you. I have a real good friend and a big supporter of the radio station. He's been supporting the station ever since it came into being in August of 2025. We will have been on the air 20 years. So we began in August of 2005. So he's been a big supporter, really, really good friend of mine. And a few months back, he said he had just read a book that he really, really enjoyed, The American Savior. And he mentioned, you know, you ought to have this author on your show, because he's from Massachusetts. He's from Revere. And my friend knew I lived close to Revere when I was growing up. And, you know, I decided to look in. And then he said, you know, I am not a reader. As a matter of fact, since college, I've probably read two books in total. Now he's 73 years old. But once I read The American Savior, I wanted to read more of Roland Marullo's books. And now he's read all the Buddha, the four books about the Buddha, Breakfast with Buddha, Lunch with Buddha, Dinner with Buddha, and Dessert with Buddha. He's just hate to use the term blown away, because I usually don't say that term, blown away, but he said he was just, it was such a message in all of your books. And he, coincidentally, he meditates between an hour and 2 hours every morning. As soon as he gets up, he begins meditating. So there's something in those books, and I just had to get in touch with you and see if you'd like to be a guest on the show, so you could share a little bit about your journey and how you have happened to write 28 books by now, and had written that trilogy about the Buddha, but now it's four books about the Buddha. And so why don't you just do that, Roland? Tell us how this all began. I know you didn't write your first book, or you didn't get your first book published till 1991, and now it's 2025, so it's almost a book a year. So just let the listeners know how all this happened and maybe how you got involved with the Buddha series.
Okay, well, first, thank you for having me on, Bob. I appreciate it. And whoever your friend is, tell him thank you, because the best way to sell books is word of mouth. And so when people say nice things about my books, it's a little embarrassing, but also very helpful, so I appreciate it. It's kind of a long story. I grew up, you know, in Revere, as you said, which is not exactly the literary capital of the world. You know, there are a lot of great people there, but it was lower middle class, working class neighborhood. And I didn't know anyone who wrote for a living, and I didn't know anyone who wrote for a hobby. So I think probably in my early years, the seed of desire to write professionally was there, but I buried it. It just was not realistic. It was like someone on Essex Street saying they wanted to be an astronaut. You know, sure, go ahead, give it a try, but it's not common where I grew up at all. So I ended up getting a scholarship to Exeter Academy. I graduated in 71. I went to BU for 2 years, transferred to Brown, got a master's in Brown, and the whole time I think I took maybe two writing courses. And I was really pretty confused guy. When I finished my master's at Brown, I lucked into a job in the former Soviet Union with USIA on a cultural exchange program. But I really had no idea what I wanted to do for a living, or consciously. I had no idea. I think probably subconsciously I knew. And so then I had different experiences. I mean, I started to, I went in the Peace Corps in Micronesia. I came home. I was sick. I was broke. I was disappointed in myself because I had left early. I was living in Alston in a crummy apartment with my girlfriend, who's now my wife. And it really was kind of a low point. But at that point, I was able to say, you know, what do you want to do when you wake up every day? Not what are your fellow graduates doing. Many of them were doing incredible things already at that age. Not, you know, what's the most prestigious thing you can do? What's the most lucrative thing you can do? What do you want to do? How do you want to spend your precious time on Earth? And even though I was in really in a pretty bad state of mind, I was able to admit to myself that what I wanted to do was write for a living. So I started then, that would have been 1978. I was 25. I started to write seriously. And 12 years later, I published my first book. In those 12 years, I drove a cab. I was a full-time carpenter for 7 years. I worked again in the Soviet Union a couple of times. I did temp work, anything I could do to pay the bills. But I would write at night. I would write on weekends and had a bunch of rejections and eventually published a book with Houghton Mifflin in 1991. And still was a while, probably another, not quite 10 more years before I could make a living completely from writing books, which really was my dream. And that happened around 1999, I guess. And so that's what I've done ever since. I just, I loved doing it. It's really deeply satisfying for me. And, that's pretty much the whole story right there.
Well, you know what I'd like to do, Roland, is since I wanted you to talk about the Buddha series, is play a sample of the Breakfast with Buddha. I think that's the one that came out. When did that actually come out? 2008 or so? Or
2007.
And it has sold, I think I read, 250,000 copies or...
Yeah, a little bit more, and it's been translated into 10 or 12 other languages. I don't know how much it's sold in those places.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to play this. It's about 4 to 5 minutes, and then we can just go right into the Buddha series. And
sure.
Okay, let's see if I can get this to come through without a problem here.
I am a private man. I made the decision, again, at Jeannie's suggestion, to write down what had happened during my days on the American road. If nothing else, I thought the story might drop a few laughs into someone's life, which is not a bad thing these days. So let me begin here. I am an ordinary, sane, American man, 44 years young, senior editor at a respected Manhattan publishing house, Stanley and Burns, that specializes in books on food. I've been married to the same woman for almost half my life. We have two teenage children. Natasha is 16 and a half, Anthony 14, an affectionate mixed-breed dog named Jasper, and a house in one of the pricier New York suburbs. Jeannie works very part-time as a freelance museum photographer and very full-time as an attentive mother. It's not a perfect life, needless to say. We've had our share of worry and disappointment, illness and hurt, and with two teenagers in the house, we sometimes experience a degree of domestic turbulence that sounds to my ear like a boiling tea kettle filled with hormones shrieking on a stove. But it is a life Jeannie and I made from scratch, without a lot of money at first or a lot of help, and we are proud of it and grateful. 6 months before my trip, a sour, new ingredient was dropped into the stew of that good life,
into the swirl of dinner parties, arguments over homework, and two-week rentals at the shore in August. My parents, Ronald and Matilda, 72 and 70, were killed in a car crash on a two-lane North Dakota highway called State Route 22. In full possession of their mental faculties, in excellent health, they were familiar voices on the end of the phone line one day, and unavailable the next. Gone. Silent. Untouchable. Hardy farm people with forceful and distinct personalities who were turned to ash and memories by a drunk just my age in a careening blue pickup. We all went out to North Dakota for the memorial service. My sister, Cecilia, who lives in New Jersey, took the train. She inherited my mother's fear of air travel. Tears were shed. There was talk of the old times, good and not so good. There was anger at the man, soon to be imprisoned, who had killed them. I expected all that. What I did not expect was the enormous feeling of emptiness that surrounded me in the weeks following my parents' burial. It was more than bereavement. It was a kind of sawing dissatisfaction that cut back and forth against the fibers of who I believed myself to be. Sometimes, even in the sunniest moods, I'd be aware of it. Turn your eyes away from the good life for just a second, and there it was. Not depression, as much as an ugly little doubt about everything you had ever done. Not confusion, exactly, but a kind of lingering question. What's the point of all this? Would be putting the question too crudely, but it was something along those lines. All this striving and aggravation, all these joys and miseries, all this busyness, all this stuff. 1,000 headlines, 100,000 conversations, emails, meetings, tax returns, warranties, bills, privacy notices, ads for Viagra, calls for donations, election cycles, war in the news every day, trips to the dump with empty wine bottles, fillings and physicals, braces and recitals, Jeannie's moods, my moods, the kids' moods, soccer tournaments, plumber's bills, sitcom characters, oil changes, wakes, weddings, watering the flower beds. All of this, I started to ask myself, leads exactly where? To a smashed-up Buick on a country highway? And then what? Paradise? All right, I'm a fan of the old idea that if you live a decent life, you rise up to heaven afterward. I'm not opposed. But sometimes, riding the commuter train home past the tenements of Harlem, or calling Natasha and Anthony away from their IMing long enough for the frenzied modern ritual of a family meal, or just standing around at a friend's 50th birthday party with a glass of Pinot Noir in one hand, I'd feel this sudden ache cutting along my skin.
That's a sample reading of the book Breakfast with Buddha by Roland Marullo. That wasn't your voice, right, Roland?
No, that was John Renett. He's a professional reader, and I think he does a good job.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. I had the pleasure of listening to several samples of your books, and I feel so. Tell us, how did that was, as I said, a preview of the book, Breakfast with Buddha. And how did this all play out in your mind? How did Buddha come into being? And Otto was the person who was telling the story, and he's the one who's having breakfast, lunch, and dinner with Buddha. So could you talk a little bit about Otto and Buddha and how they came to be?
Sure, yeah. I was raised devout Catholic, very devout, surrounded by devout Catholics, good people. And somewhere in my probably early 20s, I started to feel like some of the questions I had weren't answered by what I'd heard the priest say over every single Sunday for my whole life. And I became interested in Thomas Merton, who was a Catholic monk in a Trappist monastery in Kentucky, and he wrote best-selling books, and he kind of gave me permission to explore Eastern thought, because he did, always respectfully, I think. So I became interested in Buddhism and have a meditation practice and so on. And then to go to the book, I had become, played a little tiny bit of golf when I was a late teenager with my dad and his brothers on crappy nine-hole courses around Boston mostly. We had a lot of fun, but it wasn't very serious. And then I didn't play golf again until middle age, and I really became hooked, and I loved the game, and I wrote a book called Golfing with God that ended up being read in its entirety on 100 NPR stations nationwide, which was an incredible piece of luck, and sold very well. So the people who published that, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, the editor, called me up a couple of years later. I was in Florida, actually, on vacation with Amanda and the girls and my mother. And Chuck Adams, who's the editor at Algonquin, called me up and said, you know, we did well with Golfing with God. We'd like you to write another book for us, another novel. We don't want another book about golf. But he coined the term quirky spiritual. And he said, you know, we like that angle, and if you have some thoughts on another quirky spiritual book, we'd love to entertain the idea. So I didn't have any ideas, but I did have a wife and two kids that I had to support. So I thought for a second, I said, you know, Chuck, I've been to 45 American states, but I've never been to North Dakota, and I just have this feeling that it would evoke spiritual ideas in me. It would be inspiring to me. I think of it as mostly empty, not a lot of people, beautiful, kind of stark, remote, unvisited, off the tourist main lines. And I love to drive. I think I could drive out to North Dakota and write a good novel about it. And there was a long pause on the other end of the line, and Chuck said, you know, could you be more specific? And I said, no, not really. I just have a feeling. And he said, okay, well, I'll talk to the committee about it, the group of people who make the decisions. And I like to say they made an advance offer, commensurate with their enthusiasm for the idea, which was not very high. But I rented a car and just started to drive, knowing that eventually I would get to North Dakota. My agent lived in Bronxville. My agent at the time lived in Bronxville, so I went down to Bronxville, walked around a little bit with her, and I thought, okay, this would be a good place for the guy to begin. And I really don't plan my books. I really I try to write a good first sentence and just follow my intuition and see where it goes. So I just drove from there, and I tried to stop at places and do things that I wouldn't ordinarily do, so it would be more interesting than just a road trip. And so I went to, like, the Hershey's factory and that kind of thing, which I normally would not do. And I drove to Chicago. I was writing as I went at night in the hotels. I took very careful notes. I'd often pull off the road and write down what I saw. And I came home, waited for the kids to get out of school, and worked out. By then, I think I had about 100 pages. And we flew back to Chicago, where I had stopped the first part of the trip, and drove to North Dakota just by a circuitous route. And you know, the book came out of that trip, and it did okay the first year. I think it sold 10 or 11,000 copies in hardcover, which is not a disaster, but not great. And then it got into the book club circuit and really just took off exponentially, and has been still sells thousands of copies every year, you know, it's now 18 years later. So it's been a great gift for me. And then because people seem so interested, interested in the characters. I wrote Lunch with Buddha, Dinner with Buddha, and Dessert with Buddha.
And how did, well, since the first book that got your publisher interested in quirky spiritual, in his words, you just instinctively created the Buddha. But let me mention one thing to you, that my friend's wife, she's read your books as well, and I had mentioned to John that you know, you were going to be on the show, and he contacted her. She's in Virginia, he's in Maui. They're meeting up in Arizona, or they're meeting up in Florida somewhere. But anyway, she sent me a text, and she said, maybe you could ask Roland if he received divine inspiration to create his characters and how it came through. So how did the Buddha actually come into being? I guess you could have written another book, a quirky spiritual book, without having Buddha involved.
Yeah. The guy who's the title refers to is not actually Buddha. He's a Rinpoche. He's a Tibetan Buddhist spiritual teacher. Very quirky guy. I use the term Buddha loosely with him, and even with the things that he says, and not in some cases kind of textbook Buddha. They are not textbook Buddhism. And I've had a few letters from people complaining about that. I don't know how it came to be. I mean, I became interested in Buddhism in the way I explained to you a few minutes ago. And then I was studying karate with a guy, a local guy here near Northampton, Massachusetts. And he said he'd read this really good book called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and written by Sogyal Rinpoche. So I got a copy and I read it, and it really spoke to me. And then I got some of Rinpoche's tapes and listened to them. I drive a lot and I listened to them. He's since fallen into disgrace and died, but that's a whole other story. But the message and the message I thought was really, really great. It really spoke to me. And I have a friend who lives on the road here in western Massachusetts, Frank Ward, who's a great photographer, and he has traveled to Tibet often, and gave us a picture of a monk they call the working class monk. He's kind of a rough-looking guy. It's a beautiful photograph of this guy surrounded by a whole group of people. And I put that up on the wall. So those two things, the tapes of Sogyal Rinpoche, the photograph that Frank Ward gave us, I think put the idea in my mind for this Rinpoche, this kind of rough-edged Tibetan monk with a sly grin on his face. And I really don't plan, I don't outline, I just kind of wing it. And I feel like, and I know other authors do that too, it's just a way of opening up your subconscious and bringing out what's in there. And I don't think it's exactly divine inspiration, but maybe if you use that term widely, we're all divinely inspired by what we do, the choices we make. You know, I don't think anything happens by accident. So I've heard people say the books are out there somewhere and they're just looking for somebody to come through into the human consciousness. And that kind of makes sense to me. I don't feel like a special messenger in any way, shape, or form, you know. I'm a Revere kid. I really am not pretentious about religion. It's not a preachy book. I really try not to be preachy. I try to ask the big questions, but I don't have the answers, so I don't provide them. And so I think that's just how it happens, Bob. It just, if you get in a certain state of mind and you have certain writing skills, or, you know, like a tradesman, like carpentry skills that you've developed over time, and you open yourself to the ideas, they just come out. And then there's a lot of work to be done putting them into a form that is follows a certain line, that has a certain smoothness to it, that, you know, a story is, has to be a story in a certain way. And that's, I tend to write very quickly and then, you know, go through the manuscript 100 times, making changes.
Well, we're talking with Roland Marullo, the author of 28 books, and we're specifically focusing on the Buddha series, 4 books, Breakfast with Buddha, Lunch with Buddha, Dinner with Buddha, and Dessert with Buddha. And you're listening to your own community radio station. This is a Peace and Justice Report on WSLR, LP 96.5 FM, Sarasota, WBPV, LP 100.1 FM, Bradenton. And so the Buddha, then I would say the Buddha, we'll talk about the monk. I know he was 5'8". How did you happen to make him from Russia, right? How did you create him? Once you knew you were going to have a monk, how did he come into being?
I did not want him to be typical. You know, I did not want him to be part of the Tibetan diaspora and kind of a strict Buddhist. I knew that I wanted more flexibility than that. And I had, when I worked in the Soviet Union, I had taken the Trans-Siberian in the western part, the western half of the trip from Khabarovsk, which is on the Chinese border, to Novosibirsk, which is right in the middle of Siberia. And on that trip, I passed through different areas, and one of them I later found out was there were two of them, I think, actually. There were Buddhist enclaves there, which really surprised me. I think they're so close to the Chinese border that in ancient times people moved across into what's now Russia from China and Mongolia. And so I decided I would have him, and I know a lot about Russia. I speak Russian, and so I decided rather than have him be Tibetan from Tibet, he could be a Tibetan Buddhist from Skavarodino, which is a city you can see on the map along the Trans-Siberian and very close to the Chinese border. So I just have fun. You know, I mean, sometimes I put little things into my books that are just for me. You know, like Skavarodino means frying pan in Russian, and it's a part of Siberia that actually gets very, very hot in the summertime. So those little kind of inside jokes that I do for my own entertainment, and if one or two readers pick up on it, that's great. But occasionally I'll sprinkle a novel with a few of those little things, you know, names of friends or something like that.
And so Otto was the main character. He's the one who had breakfast, lunch, and dinner with the monk. And when I was, you know, listening to some, I did just get a couple of books out of the library, and one was Dinner with Buddha. And so I've read some of that, and I've listened to some of the previews of the other books. And I guess my question is, it was Otto. You know, when I hear Otto talking, I'm thinking it might be certain aspects of your life that come into play here. Is that, or is Otto?
That's partly true. I went to some lengths to make him different from me. So he grew up in North Dakota. He grew up Protestant. He lives in. He's, you know, a layer up from me financially. He lives in Bronxville, New York, and is a food editor. I like food. I like to eat. But so I tried to make him distinct from myself, partly so he'd be a foil to Rinpoche. He's not as steeped in Eastern religion as I am, and certainly didn't grow up like I grew up. Religion-wise, but he's a good man, and he just Rinpoche actually ends up Rinpoche is a friend of Otto's sister. That's how they meet. And originally I was going to have Otto and his sister drive across country, and I thought that would be a good conversation. But then as I was writing the book and I had Otto appear at Cecilia's home in New Jersey, all of a sudden there was this monk sitting on the deck dangling his feet over and laughing, and I realized I wanted to have Otto and the monk ride across the country. It was really a surprise to me. And one of the benefits of not outlining, I think, is that you can surprise yourself. So Otto's a little more skeptical than I am. He does have two children like I do, but he has a boy and a girl. I have two girls. The dog's name is the same as the dog we used to have. So there's some ways in which Otto's like me and a bunch of ways in which he's different.
So how did you think of having his parents killed in a crash? And
I don't know. I don't know how that came to be.
Yeah.
Really. I know his last name is Ringling, and I know we were actually in, isn't there a Ringling Museum in Sarasota?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
We were there. Amanda and I were there probably right before that phone call I talked about earlier, because we were coming across Florida from Miami to Tampa, I think. And I think we stopped, and I know we went to that museum, and I saw the name Ringling, and I had always thought that that was kind of a made-up, you know, circus name. And it struck me on one of the little plaques with information on them that Ringling was not a made-up name, that it was a fairly common German name from the upper Midwest. And that little detail stuck in my mind, and so I wanted to make the character's last name Ringling, and I thought, what's a good name to go with that? I think Otto's a good German name, so, you know, just kind of seat-of-the-pants stuff. I don't, a lot of it's not intentional, or I don't have any grand plan when I start out, but later I can try to make those things make sense.
So I know Otto had two children, and you have two children, right?
Exactly, yeah. And his wife's a photographer, my wife's a museum photographer. So some overlap, and some, in some ways, he's very different than I am.
And I know that your sister became Rinpoche's wife, and then whether I missed it in when I went through the second book, how did that actually happen, that your Otto's sister becomes the monk's wife?
Yeah, at the very beginning of Breakfast, they're just friends and maybe dating, and then in the later books, they get married, and his sister's an important character, even though she doesn't appear very often. She's kind of his opposite. He's a straight-laced publishing guy. You know, he gets up in the morning and takes the train into work in Manhattan and works all day and comes home and mows his lawn and tends to his house and so on. And his sister is what he calls flaky. She's a palm reader in the beginning of the first book and a past life regressions, and he thinks she's goofy and weird and flaky, and it turns out that's really not true. It turns out that she has something going on that he comes to admire, although it takes him a long time. And it's through her that he's introduced to Rinpoche's ideas, which really change his life. The section you read, you played, that Sean Renette read, is the very beginning of Breakfast with Buddha, and it's Otto kind of being knocked out of his complacency by the death of his parents, the sudden death of his parents, which I think happens to a lot of us. When someone dies, we begin to question things in a different way. And Otto is the kind of guy, like, he believes, a believer. He's a good man. He's a good husband. He's a good father. He's, you know, he might go to church once in a while. It's not like he's a super devout person, but he's a good guy. And he kind of thinks that's it. You know, that's what you have to do in life. That's, you know, that's your route to whatever spiritual, quote-unquote, reward there may be. And Rinpoche shows him a different level. It shows him a much more interior, deeper level of spirituality, and that really comes from Cecilia, who, as I said, Otto thinks is flaky at the beginning, and then by the end of breakfast, he's already starting to realize that she is flaky, but she's also in touch with certain aspects of life that he's not in touch with.
It's so interesting that she was a palm reader and a kind of a psychic, and she hooks up with a monk. You know, it's just
I think we, you know, those of us who have, I don't want to say traditional, straight-laced kind of ordinary lives. You know, I have a house, I have a car, I have a wife and kids, I pay my bill. You know, that's the life of the majority of people in the country. And we can sometimes look upon people like Cecilia with disdain or contempt. You know, they're doing all this strange stuff that doesn't pay the bills. On, you know, are they helping anyone? And sometimes that's true. They're a little out there. And sometimes there's something else going on. They are in touch with, you know, sometimes they're in touch with nature in a way that we're in too much of a hurry to be. And I wanted a pet idea of mine is that we walk around in disguise. That you, I remember one time when my wife and I were first married, we visited her parents. We did not have a car. Her parents had saved a bottle of champagne from the wedding. And we were getting on a bus in Pittsfield, I think it was, to go back to where we were living. And Amanda dropped the champagne bottle, and it broke. And just as we were getting on the bus, and she started to cry, she burst into tears. And the bus driver said, "That's okay, everything happens for a reason, don't worry about it." And the way he said it was so calming and immediate and beautiful that really struck both of us. And I thought, you know, that the guy's a bus driver, that's his disguise. There's something else going on with that guy. You know, and it's so easy to say, you know, he's a bus driver, it's a legitimate job, obviously, it does some good in the world, but if you look a little deeper, there may be, you know, the person who checks your groceries or fix your plumbing or sweeps the street, which actually happens in Breakfast with Buddha. Otto comes upon a street sweeping guy and asks directions, and he realizes that the guy, there's something special there. There's something deeper going on. And that's a kind of a favorite idea of mine.
Yeah, well, it's the big questions. I think you had mentioned in that preview to the Breakfast with Buddha, and right near the end, you know, Otto was saying, "Well, what's it all about? What am I doing? We're paying the bills, just a very mundane existence, and is it all worth it? And why am I here?" And so, you know, I think more people are thinking those thoughts, and more people go through each and every day. Certainly I do, you know, through most of my life, asking those questions as to, well, what am I doing here, and why am I here? And, you know, and I like to think when I meet people and I have an opportunity to help someone, I do, because I say, well, what else? What else is there to do?
Yeah, the Dalai Lama is big on that, you know, you're not always there for you. You know, you can be helpful to other people, even in small ways, like that bus driver was, or, you know, letting somebody into traffic, smiling, making a joke with somebody in line at the grocery store. There's all kinds of beautiful. I have a little book called Moments of Grace and Beauty, where I wrote it in the depths of COVID, when everybody was really kind of beaten down by the pandemic. And I collected, I think it was 30 little moments from my own life where I had seen people do these beautiful things. Like we were in Mexico, and a boy, barefoot boy, came into the breakfast restaurant begging, and the owner chased him out. But the man at the table next to us, who was dressed in an expensive suit, folded up his own breakfast sandwich in a napkin and ran out of the restaurant chasing after this boy to give him his own food. And we all, you know, we all see stuff like that all the time, or we do stuff like that. And it's, you know, the news is filled with bad stuff, but there's a lot of good stuff going on.
You know, Roland, I almost forgot when you mentioned the Dalai Lama. There are two other books I'd like to have you tell us a little bit about. And after the Buddha series, there were four, as I mentioned, people can go to your website, Roland Merulo. So it's RolandMerulo.com, RolandMerulo.com, to take a look of all the books that Roland has written. And so there's two other books I'd like to, we get about 10 to 12 minutes left, have you talk about. Well, of course, one was The Dalai Lama and the Pope Take a Road Trip Together. So maybe you can talk about how that one came into being.
Yeah, that's The Delight of Being Ordinary is the title. And probably the most fun I had writing a book. As I said, I grew up devout Catholic, and I'm more of a practicing Buddhist now. So the two spiritual figures are one from Catholicism and one from Tibetan Buddhism, the Pope and the Dalai Lama, who I don't think ever met in person, the late Pope. And I decided, when we were in somewhere in Italy, we saw something up on a wall at a ski area. I wasn't even skiing. We were just—it was summertime, and we were visiting. And it said that the Pope, one of the popes, not the most recent pope, a pope who loved to ski, might have been the Polish pope, sneaked away one day from the Vatican in disguise and went skiing at that resort. And that planted a seed in my mind. I thought, what must it be like to be the Pope? I mean, constantly in public, constantly under the public eye. Every word you say publicly, you know, can be taken this way or that way. And I thought that must be a terrible stress, and I could see why a pope would want to sneak away. So I came up with this idea that the Pope and the Dalai Lama both, they're meeting officially, and they just come, they just decide, you know, we're constantly on. And what if we just kind of sneaked away and took a few days off? And they're the cousin of the Pope and his wife are the ones who facilitate this. And they, she's kind of does the disguises because they can't. They obviously have to go in disguise. And they make a road trip around Italy, and they have these conversations where they talk about the differences and similarities between Eastern thought and Western thought, and Catholicism and Buddhism specifically. They meet different characters, and it was just a lot of fun to write. I had been to all the places where they go. I love road trip books, and so what I like to do is raise the big questions, talk about big spiritual ideas, but have a sense of humor about it because, you know, Bob, I mean, the things that people argue about most are politics and religion, really. So I don't want to, I like to provoke, but not provoke to anger, like provoke to think about things. And if you have a little sense of humor and treat it with some lightness, I think it's more palatable for the reader. The other couple of books you might be referring to, Vatican Waltz, is a little more serious book. It's not as funny. It's about a woman who grows up in Revere, actually very, very devout, a Catholic woman who decides that God is calling her to become a priest, and she really feels strongly that that's what's happening, and she gets a little encouragement from some local priests and a lot of discouragement, and ultimately goes to the Vatican and meets with the cardinal, and all kinds of stuff happens after that, but that book's a little more seriously, but it's also another book where I'm trying to explore spiritual ideas. And American Savior, which you mentioned at the beginning, is Jesus comes to earth and runs for president of the United States, which is another very quirky idea. I don't know where that came from, but you know, what would happen if you had someone who claimed to be Jesus, not only claimed to be, but seemed to be, and decided to run for office? What would happen? How would America respond? You know, how would people, would they embrace the idea? Would they be feel like it was sinful? So it was fun. I just play with this stuff, and I try to mix the really serious, deep questions with a little bit of playfulness and humor and quirky and odd, eccentric situations.
Well, now more so than ever in what's going on here in the United States and around the world, it's, I would say one has to look at things that way or they might get into serious trouble mentally. So,
That's true.
You know, I was speaking to my friend who read, that was the first book he had read of, and then he went on to the Buddha books, and, you know, he had mentioned that he's in Maui right now, living in Maui for a while, and he was at a thrift store the other day, and he saw a T-shirt, Marianne Williamson for President 2024. And yeah. He brought it up to me. He said, well, if Marianne Williamson wasn't running, I probably would have written in Jesus' name. But, you know, Marianne Williamson was a spiritual enlightened being. And unfortunately, within the Democratic Party, they just treated her as though she was like, I don't know, it's difficult to say how they treated her. What, not very well, that's for sure.
Yeah, like a little bit like Otto's sister, you know, seen as being flaky. And, you know, I mean, I grew up with the Bible stories. I heard them every week. And if you actually try to apply those stories to contemporary living, some of the flakier people are probably closer to the what was being said than the official, you know, the really wealthy people. You know, some of those Bible stories are really provocative. You have two coats, give one away. You know, who does that? Who do you know who gives away half of what they have? You know, but that's what you're asked to do if you believe in that tradition or you live in that tradition. And so it's fascinating to me to try to apply that ancient wisdom and to both Christian and I've read some Jewish mystical traditions and Sufism and Hinduism and Buddhism, and they all basically say the same thing, and the same thing is very hard to practice in real life. And do unto others as you would have them do unto you sounds very simple. It's part of every one of the major religions, and yet to try to actually behave that way is tremendously challenging, I think.
People have to get out of their own self in terms of their own inhibitions or their own the anxiety that holds people back. And, you know, I think I had listened to on the Pope and the Dalai Lama, I listened to her. I had that book, and I've read about half of it. And even they have fears that they have to face, you know.
Sure.
So that's the interesting thing, you know, that we all have those fears, no matter who we are, or how high up on the echelon we are, as far as, you know, status and income and all of that. Just like people down who are on the street corner looking for a dollar bill.
Yeah, and we have a million ways of protecting ourselves from thinking about those big questions and those fears. You know, we keep busy and we earn money, or we play golf like I do, or we have bills, or family issues, or health issues. They're all reasonable, but in a certain way, they all also keep issues. And I think when you come close to the end of your life, for many people, those issues, you can't hide them anymore. You can't run away from them. You can't, you know, you can't put a curtain between them and you, a curtain of busyness or earning or worrying or whatever it might be. And I think people like the Pope and Dalai Lama and real spiritual people, many monks, and they make a point of facing those things. They focus on them. They bring them to their attention daily rather than just occasionally when... And that's the point probably of Otto's parents being killed in a car crash, you know, that kind of thing will shake you up and show you that all the busy stuff you're doing is necessary, but at some level secondary, and that's what happens with Otto.
You know, I think about the pandemic and when, you know, they closed the cities down and, you know, and, you know, people were put in a position and they might not even have the job to go to. So they were put into a position where I would hope a good percentage of people, you know, looked at life in a different from a different vantage point and look, what is important here, you know.
Exactly. There's some saying something like, all the trouble in the world comes from the fact that we can't sit quietly in a room for an hour and do nothing. You know, that like if you sit quietly and do nothing for an hour, you really, some of the distractions go away and you have to face those things and the deeper issues. And maybe we should do that a little more.
Well, I believe that yes, as you said, some people need something going on all the time. And the same people who say, well, they might drink and take drugs because... They, you know, when they begin thinking about, you know, what's important or how they're going to face their fears, they just can't do it. So
yeah, right.
And it's,
and then you have the billionaires who spend all their time and mental energy thinking of ways to make more money while there are kids starving in the world and kids hungry in America.
I know it's. I know when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, those thoughts came into my mind that, you know, there are people starving in America. I heard about Appalachia when I was 10 years old, and people suffering. And at that time, what are we doing? We're bombing people and killing innocent people in Vietnam and in other places, and so. You know,
seems to be the way the world works. I think all we can do is, to the extent we're able, you know, try to give a little bit to others. I mean, I think it's a lot to ask to completely forego your own life and family and work and income and devote yourself to others like a Mother Teresa. I think a few people can do that, but the rest of us, we can push ourselves a little bit to be more generous, more giving, more empathetic, you know, more kinder.
I know we can. And Roland, I can't believe the hour has flown by, and I really, really appreciate your being available this morning. And, you know, this is a Peace and Justice Report, and so often we're talking about what's going on in Israel and in Ukraine and Russia and, you know, all those things. But real peace is only obtained when one person at a time, and we're working on ourselves to become more peaceful, more enlightened, more aware, so that hopefully it can go up to the leaders in this world that there's another way. Maybe there's another way.
Yeah. I would keep trying. I think I agree with you 100%. I wish some of those leaders had maybe spent more time pondering these things, and maybe they wouldn't be doing some of the things that they're doing, but that seems to be the way humanity works. And, you know, we play our role. We have to be the people we are and do the best we can do.
Well, I'm going to sign off, Roland, and I want to let the people know your website again, Roland Merulo, MERULLO.com. Take a look at all the books that Roland has written over the last, since 1991, 28 books. And I'm sure if you've enjoyed this conversation, you might like to pick up Breakfast or Lunch or Dinner with Buddha. So thank you very much, Roland. Why don't you hang on for 30 seconds and while I sign off here.
And thanks for having me, Bob. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Well, that's the Peace and Justice Report today. Stay tuned for next week for Tom Walker. And stay tuned right now.